Hello and welcome to Indie Business Radio for Monday, November 23rd, 2009. I'm your host, Donna Maria, and you have arrived at the one place where we empower you to enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way. Now, don't move your dial. It's me, Donna Maria. I know I sound a little bit funny because I'm fighting a little bit with a cold today, but I assure you, even though I sound sort of raspy, it is me, and I'm excited to be here. Today's show is sponsored by The Media Is You, intensive hands-on social media training, especially for indie business owners. I'm coming to Atlanta, Chicago, New York, and San Francisco. Visit www.themediaisyou.com to register and find out how you can save $100 with my early bird pricing program. If you're joining us from indiebusinessradio.com, I invite you to click the chat link so you can join us there and chat your questions and comments live on Twitter. You can also use Facebook to do that if you'd like. You can visit my Twitter page at Indie Business to get the chat link as well. Well, today our world is filled with opportunities for small and independent business owners like never before. Yet, as many new opportunities as there are also some challenges in this new global economy. My guest today describes today's business world as swift and severe, and he has some innovative thoughts on just exactly what businesses need to do to thrive in it. His name is Dr. Bruce Piasecki, and his new book, The Surprising Solution, Creating Possibility in a Swift and Severe World, addresses these and other issues. Bruce Piasecki is the president and founder of the American Hazard Control Group, a management consulting firm specializing in leadership, product development, and environmental corporate strategy. He has authored several books and hosted multinational workshops with all kinds of companies. And it's like a walking encyclopedia of knowledge when it comes to the intersection of business and its ever-increasing global nature. Bruce's work has been with the world's largest companies, but since as indie business owners, our path intersects with them whether we like it or not, he has some interesting perspective, and we'll be exploring them on today's show. Welcome to Indie Business Radio, Bruce.
Hey, good to be back, Donna. It's a delight.
Well, and as you all know, if you're listening out there, Bruce was on the show last year talking about one of his earlier books called World Inc., which is a fantastic book which addresses some of these perspectives. And so, Bruce, can you bring us up to date a little bit since then and up to The Surprising Solution? How did this new book come about?
Yeah, well, World Inc. Took off in 8 different languages, and it won some awards in Japan and also in Europe. This wonderful enterpriser, Dominique Rocker, who owns the publishing house, felt that, you know, we should update it in relationship to the financial crisis and, you know, the whole problem of Bernie Madoff and how do you, you know, discover the big lie and how do you operate, essentially. So the new book, The Surprising Solution, is about how to make smart moves, a small company, mid-size or large company, relative to the financial crisis and the capital constraints of that, and also relative to carbon challenges in our new climate change world. And since your motto is enjoy your life and have it your way, the book is very much about how to navigate your life and your business and create possibility in this swift and severe world.
Well, Bruce, let's talk for a second about the financial part of that. It's interesting that you talk about you know, how the issues with Enron and other companies sort of created this financial, whatever we call it, meltdown, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting how capital has been affected, because one of the things I know about the audience I mainly serve is that we've never really tried to get capital outside of credit cards. And so all of those, not everyone, but for the most part, we've kind of been bootstrappers and, you know, sell some 401k shares or maybe get family and friends to invest or donate to get the business started and then rely on some credit cards until we can kind of bootstrap our way out of that. So what is your perspective on how, if at all, that larger picture has impacted very, very small businesses who may not have really wanted to go the investor or, you know, a lot of credit route where their businesses were concerned anyway?
Great question, Donna Maria, and I would like to say that one of the surprising solutions in this new book is that more mid-size and large companies have to follow the bootstrapping and credit discipline of the smaller independent innovators. What I'm arguing in the chapter Money Matters, which is a phrase my grandmother used when she was an immigrant coming over from Poland, she would say the word money matters as if it was a physical thing that she wanted her grandson, even at 10, to notice, that that money was a thing, just like human talent is a thing, and you shouldn't be distracted by credit worthiness. And so if we look at the extreme, I wrote a piece recently from this new book called Michael Jackson and the Stress of Easy Credit. If you live in a world in which credit can be given to you even if you don't have a good plan, even if you don't have a good return on investment, even if then you get distracted by easy credit. And so the lessons in my book, well, part of the surprise on money, is that often the smaller innovator has been more disciplined about money, that they understand that money will not manage itself in a closet, and they know that money matters. And so with a kind of apocalyptic conciseness, I say in this new book, everyone, every firm needs to handle money with care, not with abandon.
And so what you're saying then is that it's an old concept that sort of we lost a little bit of sight of in the larger sense.
Absolutely.
And we now have to return to whether we're large or small.
And that's why I felt it appropriate to make reference to my grandmother, in the sense that if you think about it, since World War II, we've been kind of distracted by bigger is better, faster is better, more is better, when actually the challenges of today are about how do you do more with less? How do you have the force and grace in your product strategy that you can do something the world needs, you know, be it a better shoe or a better manufacturing process, but to do it with less, to do more of it with less, is the essence of the book. So one other thought that I tried to flip in The Surprising Solution is that there's so much talk these days, Donna, about sustainability.
Right.
And I say that could be a distraction, just like easy credit, unless we realize that the essence of sustainability is frugality. Let's learn how to be frugal, and that makes the better company.
And when you say sustainability, what exactly do you mean?
Well, you know, a lot of the clients I work for a Warren Buffett company right now called Shore Industries, and they're the nation's largest maker of flooring, right? They make flooring from carpet to laminate to hardwood to engineered woods. To make a long story short, they spend a lot of money on electricity. And so part of my day-to-day work with them in their growth council for the last 2 years is to get them to take their energy bill and reduce it in the next 5 years 25%, to do more with less. In the act of doing that, they actually save $52 million each year.
Okay.
So the scale of what I talk about is to take these principles of frugality and apply them in any company. I mean, whatever the size of the company, be it 10 people or 25 or 50, if they can reduce their electricity bill and become more inventive, if they can reduce their material costs. And so essentially what I'm getting back to is this fundamental principle of competing on frugality.
Okay, now a light bulb is going off in my head, because you're saying that even if a company is not attracted by being green or eco-friendly or anything like that, if they're just attracted by money,
yes,
saving money and creating more of it by using less of it, then the ultimate result is going to be eco-friendly anyway.
I believe so. Witness Toyota versus GM. Essentially, if you look, and I write about this in the new book, there's a chapter called Toyota and the Search for the Superior Car that's been updated to show why GM needed a $51 billion bailout, while Toyota is growing even in these tough markets. If you learn to compete on frugality, if you learn to compete on lean manufacture, if you learn to make your advertising budgets effective rather than mega, what you essentially do is you find the fun in the company, you find the soul of the company, and you also get the satisfaction. So my book is about the mind shift, that it's not about just going efficient. It's about going to towards frugality by doing more with less.
This concept is so interesting to me because for so long, I mean, when I started my business, I sold stock. And so for me, as you just described, I was like, money matters all the way. I only had a certain amount of money to get started, and when that ran out, which it eventually did, you know, it was all up to me. I didn't want to deal with credit cards or loans to any great extent. So the beauty of what you're saying is that for small businesses, in a lot of ways, what you're describing is already in our DNA.
I think so. And it's about celebrating that, Donna Maria, and exploiting it in a really powerful way. I think it's wrong-headed to think that the world wants these companies to be marginalized. I believe that we need the innovation of small business. We need the innovation of the key suppliers, and that the only way to outsmart the fear of the future is to liberate this type of creative possibility, to make it better with less. And it's not the same, Donna, as just looking at this from an engineering perspective. If you look at it as an item of yield improvement, you'll find a way to optimize the result. What my work is about taking that strategic quantum leap, doing something that will be a lasting change, taking the risk of a complex challenge. And so I believe that in the spirit of your listening audience, that those who understand money matters, those who understand that money will not manage itself, they might select the right staffer rather than two wrong staffers and one right staffer. They might select the very best product family as opposed to a gargantuan family that doesn't have a wise and lasting margin. So these days, you know, having been a management consultant for hundreds of companies, I'm developing this discipline of frugality as a way of competing in the near future.
So when you see a small business, one of the things I see a lot is a lot of small companies feel as though they can't compete with larger companies in their same industry. And I don't mean multinational, huge companies like you've been dealing with, but just big, maybe just national companies. It's impossible to compete with them unless they offer a full panoply of competing products as well. And that's not really true, is it?
I don't think so at all. And in fact, where the waste and the corruption and the greed comes in certain firms that are destined to fail, the ones that get too big too fast, it's because they're pursuing this whole idea that they got to have a brick for every space in the pyramid. The small firms, in a sense, my firm is small. It's never been bigger than 43 people. And in fact, it's been most creative when it's been less than 43 people.
Right.
So the issue here is that, you know, like in the best hockey games, go to your strategy sessions and ask yourself, what is going to really give a body check to my opponent? And often you might discover something you need to do because you're finding that that opponent is wasting too many different products, too many different approaches, right? And so you can give them a real healthy body check and get a competitive advantage by doing it in a more disciplined, less diverse way. A case in point, it took us 2 years at Toyota to discover that they had a competitive advantage in having less dealerships than GM.
Mm.
GM had three times as many dealerships, and so Toyota could deliver an innovation more than three times as fast because they didn't have to negotiate and re-educate all those dealers. So sometimes I go back to this great book. I mean, I'm telling a story here that hopefully your listeners will appreciate. When I was a pre-med student at Cornell 33 years ago, I had the advantage of inviting this huge man, a huge thinker from England called E.F. Schumacher, and he had been the head of the British Coal Board during World War II. He changed my life. He had just written a book at the end of his career called Small is Beautiful, Economics as if People Mattered. In many ways, my book, The Surprising Solution, Creating Possibility in a Swift and Severe World, is my attempt to update that approach a third of a century later to say, small is beautiful,
right.
Fast is beautiful, severe is actually cleansing. All of the ones that are wrong-headed about this are going to be cleansed out of the system now.
Right. Very, very very interesting perspective and certainly very encouraging thoughts for small and independent business owners. We're talking today with Dr. Bruce Piasecki, author of The Surprising Solution, Creating Possibility in a Swift and Severe World. This is Indie Business Radio. I'm your host, Donna Maria. We'll be right back.
Why is everyone listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com? Because it's the future of talk radio. Every day, more and more people are finding internet radio as not just an alternative media, but as a replacement to traditional AM and FM broadcast stations. Internet radio offers a wider variety of programs, convenient on-demand listening that meets your schedule, and fewer commercial interruptions. And GlobalTalkRadio.com is already leading the way by matching this content with a highly targeted internet audience. GlobalTalkRadio.com offers its listeners one of the widest programming varieties on the internet, from business and finance to self-improvement, paranormal, health, literature, romance, politics, and more. There are also opportunities for prospective hosts who would like to host their own weekly or one-time talk shows. Want to learn more? Check us out at www.globaltalkradio.com and see the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. We're talking today with Dr. Bruce Piasecki, author of the new book, The Surprising Solution, Creating Possibility in a Swift and Severe World. And before we took our break, Bruce was sharing with us a lot of his really insightful perspectives on how the behavior and occurrences where large businesses, very large businesses of late are concerned, really sort of trickle across to impact and also positively encourage and provide neat opportunities for small businesses. So, Bruce, when we talk about that, one of the things your book discusses is the interconnection between investors, consumers, and businesses. And I wanted to get your thought on this because when you talk about small businesses being able to be nimble and move, as you say, swiftly in a severe world, one of the things that we have to deal with more and more is regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like your thoughts on and your perspective on this issue, because what I have found is that lawmakers, policymakers, and regulators are used to dealing with industries that are composed of a homogenous group of companies. They all pretty much look the same. And the ones that don't look the same kind of fly a little bit under the radar to some extent. And they don't have a consequence because no one knows about them that much anyway. So what we're seeing now is industries that have been traditionally participated in by very, very large companies that have lobbying groups and lawyers and all these types of people that can speak on their behalf, these industries are now populated as well by very, very small companies that have been able to participate because of the Internet.
Well, that's what I was going to say about regulation. But I'd rather have you finish your thought, Donna, because I think it's building to something.
Well, I'll try to be brief. I was just trying to set the stage for the question. What I'm finding is that the laws and the way they are being passed has not changed to keep up with the dynamics that are so different in various different industries now.
I agree with you, and that is, in fact, one of the fundamental parts of this book, where I'm saying to all business owners and to all business innovators that don't wait for the regulations, because in the end, the regulations are going to support and endorse the least common denominator. I think that what we have to do, because you cannot and shouldn't ever think of a regulation as anything but the floor of a business mansion. You know, these are the basic things that society has asked us to do in order to swim in a corporate pond. You know, the rules of diversity, the rules of health, the rules of security and privacy, you know, the rules of the environment. And so the mansion that I build in The Surprising Solution as a book describes regulation as the floor, but tries to get back into the spirit of innovation of the people rapidly climbing up the steps. And so, thanks to the Internet, the first rule of regulation is that the small business owner can find out what they need to do without needing a lobbyist, without going to Washington through the Internet. Mm-hmm. Now, this was never possible before, and this is a great development because, so take again, I use this large example in the book, Toyota. Many of the car manufacturers were lobbying Washington to not allow improvements in fuel efficiency, right? The corporate average fleet efficiency standard was a composite of 25.4 miles per gallon represented by all automakers. Well, Toyota decided to do a vehicle that went 46 miles per gallon. Now, that's, so they got the psychic and the spiritual and the market advantage of going after that innovation. Mm-hmm. I think that if your listeners who are the innovators, who are the creative, who are the bootstrappers, if they think of regulation, it's probably not worth a cent to try and fight a regulation, mm-hmm. right? Because it takes tens of thousands to fight a regulation. It's mm-hmm. it's healthier to think of that as just the basement floor of your mansion. And what mm-hmm. you really want to do is, how do I think about a product that's so appealing that it's two steps up the steps beyond the regulation, so people say, I need this cosmetic or I need this sock, because not only does it comply, but it excels. And I think the very essence of capitalism is that the products that get noticed are those that are exceptional.
Right.
I think we've left a world of commodity pricing. I think we're entering a world where people are willing to pay something for a Nike sneaker or something for Starbucks, because it's giving them not only price and quality, it's also giving them something they socially need.
Uh-huh.
A sense
uh-huh.
of community at Starbucks,
uh-huh.
athleticism to women in the Nike. And so although I do a lot of my learning by watching the behavior uh-huh. of the well-studied giants, what I'm really now doing in this new book is taking the innovation of the smaller entity and bringing it back to the giants.
Well,
that's what was missing.
Speaking of Starbucks, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wanted to get your thoughts on this. I read an article in the, I think it was the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal last week, that spotlighted Starbucks businesses that don't bear the Starbucks brand. They are actually Starbucks franchisees who have been given permission, or whatever the correct terminology is, by Starbucks to sell the Starbucks products, but to brand themselves as independent coffee shops.
That is fascinating. That's a sign of the fact, don't you think, Donna, that people are getting tired of the giants?
I love that. I love
yeah.
that Starbucks
yeah, yeah.
has decided to do that. And I guess, I mean, they're even allowed to sell certain products that are made on a small scale by local people in the community.
That's fascinating. And, you know, it essentially, let's think for a minute about being dramatic in our speech, because you'll find in my new book, the reason I chose to call it The Surprising Solution is it's very colorful. It's about helping us think things that we might be a little prejudiced about thinking. So I believe that innovators are more like a Bambi. They're beautiful, they're swift, they're cute, than like a Godzilla. I don't actually say that in the new book, but what I'm trying to say is that capitalism has always come about and has always grown by that Bambi, that suddenly a new concept that's very attractive that
mm-hmm.
people
mm-hmm.
haven't thought of, suddenly then that can get big for a while. It could be growing 20% annually for some time. So I think I even have a passage in the book, Donna. I wonder what your listeners think of this over time. And they can email me at bruce@ahcgroup.com. I have a thought that, you know, when I started my company in 81, I had a folder of the Fortune 500 as my targets, and I'm now stunned to realize how many of them have gone obsolete. You know, how Dow bought Union Carbide and is now buying Rahman Haas and so forth and so on. So that even the giant volcanoes
mm-hmm.
fall underwater. And so I was thinking about how some oceanographers recently discovered that there were 30,000 volcanoes under water that we never see from
right.
the air. They're called seamounts.
Right.
In many ways, my book is about the 30,000 small innovators that are creating new lava to create the moment when things come above sea, where you start to see the island, when you start to say, Well, that's a good thing that Starbucks is doing. Or when you start to say, well, that's a really important way to look at a car. Or, you know, the people that are now innovating to try and make computing, where you can buy a computer in India for less than $200.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going to make solutions in this overpopulated smaller world.
Right, right. Well, we're going to make sure we repeat your email address there at the end, and I'm going to be the first one to use it because the things you're discussing are fascinating to me. I have to admit it. It takes me longer than your average bear to wrap my meager brain around all the things you're talking about because there are so many things that intersect here. I want to get back for a second, if you don't mind, to that regulation issue.
Okay.
One of the things I wanted to get your take on is just to give you a very, very brief history on something I'd like you to comment on. There's, of course, lead is not a good thing in consumer products. And so last year, Congress passed a new law called the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, which was designed to curb large companies' use of lead in their products that were aimed at children under the age of 12. So there was implemented a new requirement that all companies that targeted their products at children of that age had to test those products before they went to market for the presence of lead. And there was a certain, I don't know, whatever parts per million that was acceptable, and anything above that was a product that was not being sold legally, so it had to be taken off the market. What happened as a result of that, this is kind of getting back to that regulatory issues I was talking about, is that thousands and thousands of tiny businesses who were not contributing to that problem and who had grown their businesses over a period of time doing what you said, being innovative, being green, being different, moving way above the floor that the federal government had set, went out of business in one fell swoop because they didn't know about, and part of the problem is addressed, as you said, by the fact that the Internet brings everything out into the open. I think this is sort of maybe a transition period where last year that just didn't happen, but what did happen was once the Consumer Product Safety Commission got their hands on that new law, that's when the sleeping giant of small businesses woke up. But by then it was too late because the law had already been passed and the regulator can't do anything about it at that point. So I would love to get your comments or thoughts, if any, as a person who's been involved in business at such a high level for such a long time, on, I mean, small businesses at some level can start by saying, you know, I'm going to go above and beyond what the regulator says. But at some point, because of the pressures of consumer groups or whatever the case may be, the behavior of sometimes, not putting everybody in a box, but sometimes the behavior of companies with the resources to behave however they want, create an environment where something has to be done, but the adverse impact falls on the companies that are least available or least able to handle it.
I'd like to say two things at once about the lead case. First of all, I'm not as close to it as you are or should be, but what I believe is even if there is a regulatory misstep where the government may have inadvertently hurt hundreds or thousands of innovators, I do believe that there is a permanent face to government, and it will correct itself so that it does want innovation regarding lead. I see this, for example, regarding how do you degrease military equipment, guns, and machinery. In my January 27 and 28 workshops, where 80 innovators and leaders are coming to Phoenix, and you can see the agenda at ahcgroup.com, there is a CEO, Laura Roberts, from Pantheon Chemical, where when OSHA passed a new law regarding chromium in the workplace, I'm sure that many of the normal people that used chromium in various processes were hurt. But in her case, she was vastly helped because she had figured out a way to do these complex things with biological agents as opposed to agents based on chromium.
Right.
So I would believe that when it has to do with heavy metals, society has come to the knowledge that they know they are real hazards, that these are biological threats to the future generations of kids. And so when it comes to something like lead and chromium, I believe that those businesses that might have been temporarily hurt, if they collect the industrial voice and speak to their representative and senator and eventually D.C., the system will correct itself, because without a doubt the science is saying that we have to improve on lead, chromium, and related heavy metals.
Right, right. So you're saying that this is the last time we want to be quiet. We have to go back and make sure that the impact is fully explained and described.
Absolutely. You got to fight that fight with the good science, because you're probably on the right side. But it does bring up a larger generic issue of strategy. Right. If you think of any small business is like a sailboat, it's not like a warrior. It doesn't have 2,000 people on it. It's got a few sails on it, maybe two or three sails.
Right.
And so you have to make sure that the tact of the sailboat as it approaches the wind is informed enough about regulatory change so that suddenly it's not stilled by a change. But at the same time, you also have to adjust the rudder so that you're moving in the direction ahead of where others are going. So I've often thought, you know, for example, starting my small firm, I had to find three mutually supporting revenue streams, because at some points one or two of the product streams we were going after would decline due to a down market or due to something else. So I think all small firms have to find ways to compete in a small sailboat at sea.
It's interesting that you just talked about what some people describe as multiple income streams.
Yes.
It's the way that sounds sometimes. But your analogy is kind of neat. You're comparing the sailboat to require to have, you know, two or three different sails, so that if one flops, there's two more to sail you home to shore.
Absolutely. So like in my little group, one of the most stable streams since 1981 has been what we call the Corporate Affiliates Leadership Workshops, where there's always 80 people that want to learn for every 6 months for us about what's the latest innovation, what's the latest way of thinking about competing on price, quality, and social needs. So for 20 years, we've been charging a stable rising price for this service called the Corporate Affiliates. Now, when it comes to the high-end stuff, which is the big sale, the main sale, you know, working for a Toyota or working for a Warren Buffett, that changes the whole boat, because we're so little for a long time, but you don't want it to totally change the boat, and so you always need two or three of them, you know, blowing wind into that sale. And then in the back, there's another stream, you know, which is the stream of the revenue generated from the books and the talks. And so I'm sure lots of people have done that model even better than I'm trying.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that. We've had several people on the show recently who've talked about, as you just have shared so generously from your experience, how they have also had to do that. And it's the ones, it seems, who think about that from the very beginning. That is, they may not have the financial ability to set all those sales free at the same time, but starting with the strongest one with a plan toward making sure that the other two follow closely behind seems to have been a basic business model that's worked for a lot of people.
Well said, and I think that strategy really might boil down to having a few good options rather than 100 on your menu, just a few. You know, in writing the book, I'll tell you, one of the more pleasant leaders to reread his work is Abe Lincoln. Because Abe Lincoln has many surprising solution principles in him. And number one, he never thought that the nation should split apart.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the kind of guy that wanted to keep the company whole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, within a few days of him taking office, 10 days, the Confederate States succeeded. But he wanted to make sure that sale was never stripped off of America. You know what I mean? That he did everything he could. Persistence to keep the company whole, to make sure that it had at least two or three sales in it, you know, the sale of Southern revenue as well as the sale of the Northern, and then huge investments in Western.
Interesting. We're gonna finish with that thought after we come back from our break, Bruce. We're talking with Bruce Piasecki, author of The Surprising Solution, Creating Possibility in a Swift and Severe World. The book is available at Amazon.com and also at Bruce's website at www.ahcgroup.com. This is Donna Maria, Indie Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Want to stay on top of what's new in the radio industry? Sign up for a free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio, available exclusively to listeners of globaltalkradio.com, and find out what's new in the world of online radio. Listeners can find out about new shows and special guests. People with something special to offer can find out how to become a guest and how to prepare for an interview. And prospective hosts will find a valuable resource for everything from planning their new program to selecting topics and guests, recouping expenses by selling advertising, and more. Sign up today for your free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio by visiting www.globaltalkradio.com and learn about the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. We're having a fantastic conversation this afternoon with Bruce Piasecki, author of The Surprising Solution. And for those of you who are interested in following up on some of the really interesting and innovative insights that Bruce is sharing, Bruce, tell us where's the best place to go to get your book?
Yeah, I would recommend you go to 800ceo.com. You can see a free excerpt at changethis.com or industryweek.com. You know, just put in Piasecki, and it'll come up in all of those three. But to buy the book, I recommend either 800ceo.com or amazon.com like you did.
Oh, that's great. You have really made the rounds of making the book available at a lot of different places. That's wonderful. We've been talking to you. I think you were finishing up a thought before we took our last break.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about, I was asked recently what was the best leadership advice I ever got, and I thought about it for 2 weeks and said, reading Abe Lincoln. And I think I learned five things from him that are embodied in my book, The Surprising Solution. The first, that the world of superior leadership is not simple, but needed more than ever, needed in small firms, large firms, middle-sized firms. Second thing is that we all know that failure and resistance are kind of constant irritants in what we do, but those constant irritants, Lincoln shows, makes the pearl called leadership. I mean, it's, you know, the good example that I was beginning to talk about is that just 10 days after office, the Confederate States of America succeeded from the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And so he spent 2 years trying to make sure that he kept the company whole, because essentially when he was elected, there was a hostile takeover that ends up leaving half his company at risk. So I think to keep it whole is a big part of keeping it growing. The other thing I learned about Lincoln, and hopefully you can sense this in the interview, is that he told stories. My book is full of stories because it's through articulating the paradoxes of a story that you realize innovation is not black and white. It's a very colorful thing.
So I want to make sure we get these five things, and you've mentioned three: telling stories, failure and resistance creating the pearl of called leadership, and the world of superior leadership being simple but needed more than ever. Were there some more?
There are. I think the other one is that Lincoln recognized that the future world that he wanted was going to be swift and severe. And then the fundamental thing that Lincoln's entire life was about was creating possibility. So, you know, there's a lot of talk now that we have a new president, Obama, about Obama and Lincoln. And that's part of what inspired me in writing this book, is to go back and read Lincoln. He is amazing about innovation, how to develop leadership skills that people can trust, how to communicate needed change. So all of that is in my new book as well.
What Is there a book or a biography or any a movie or anything that you would recommend for someone to get started with to study Lincoln?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking that. I cite one in The Surprising Solution, and this is after reading, you know, about 10 or 15 on Lincoln. There was a CEO of a small company by the name of Donald Phillips, P-H-I-L-I-P-S. Never met him, just came across his book. His book is called Lincoln on Leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Time Warner. Beautiful book that really helped me underline a lot of my thinking in writing this new book for you all.
Okay. I'm glad that you mentioned that because certainly he has, Lincoln has always, even without President Obama, obviously had a significant impact on the world. And I think recently, because the president talks about him so much, a lot of other people are also talking about him a lot more than even before, which was probably quite a bit, I just don't know about. So that's really good. Let's talk for a second about leadership, because you know what, Bruce, I work with very small business owners who sometimes do not start their business thinking of themselves as leaders because their business isn't big, because maybe they don't have employees, so they're really only leading themselves. Can you share some of these pearls of wisdom gained from your failure and resistance experience over the years about how we as small and independent business owners who have historically been overlooked, but now that's changing. How can we change our mindsets to see ourselves as the leaders that we need to be to create the kind of companies that you're talking about?
Well said. You know, this is exciting to me because I haven't been asked that question, but let me try and answer. First, I think a small business owner learns how to do their thing through question-based marketing. They don't have a big sales force. They don't have a huge marketing force. They don't have lobbyists. They themselves have to be question-based leaders. The world is so big, you have to ask a question of it. I think the second thing I
know. What do you mean by question-based leaders?
Well, you know, most of the firms that I come to advise, they have these huge, you know, marketing plans, and they're all, they don't really necessarily ask the customer what they want. What is your unmet need? What do you really need now and 3 years from now? So question-based marketing is nothing different than having a good interview where the questions are good. I think that in my little firm, I'm looking for people who aren't afraid to ask a leading question, who aren't afraid to shape a follow-up question to that first question. It's not just analysis and diagnosis. It's about finding out what somebody needs, right?
Okay.
I think the second feature that small business people have leadership skills on is a sense of what's needed next. So you might be, you know, if you're a Procter & Gamble or if you're a Unilever, you think you know what the customers currently want to buy.
Mm-hmm.
But the small business person has a sense of, hey, man, they might need this next, right? So Tom Chappelle comes up with a new kind of toothpaste or Bob Stiller at Green Mountain Coffee Roasters comes out with like a homegrown, this earth kind of feeling to the coffee. And it's a great stock right now for a small innovator. So I believe that being able to live in the Surprising Solution, I talk a lot about being able to live in the current market while at the same time thinking about tomorrow's market.
Right. Okay. Okay, so that's good. And because we usually are, as I mentioned earlier, I sometimes use the term consumer business owners to kind of describe the kind of businesses I'm talking about. I wanted to get your comment on that, too, now that I mention it, because it does seem to me that historically there's been this dichotomy. There's consumers, and then there's business owners.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that more and more now, their paths are overlapping in ways that maybe they overlapped before the industrial age, but I wasn't around then, so I don't know what that looked like. What are your comments on that and how those distinctions? Because when I think about how this company is governed, I think about the agencies and you know, nonprofits and other sorts of entities that are set up to serve consumers so that we don't get dinged with too many banking fees and we don't get, you know, lead in our products and all that sort of thing. And then there's a totally separate strategy, it seems to me, that businesses are addressed under. And that's always been the way it is. But now I'm seeing, and I'm wondering if you're seeing, a convergence that is new to a lot of people, certainly new to me.
Definitely. It's fun talking to you again because I see that same set of tributaries coming into the same river. Your listeners can read about it in industryweek.com, where I have, I call them social response capitalists,
okay,
where you can be a business owner and a consumer and doing business-to-business deals at the same time. So
right.
Bob Stiller can generate his coffee in Vermont and sell it on airplanes to make it national. So he's
right.
both a business owner, he thinks of it as the consumer in an airplane, and suddenly he can work with giant airlines.
Right, right. And I think, so we really need to, I think to some extent what you're describing is a huge opportunity to empower ourselves, and we have a window of time to do it in.
I'm with you.
Is that fair to say?
I think that sums up why my book is about New Grounds for Hope.
When we think about that window, are there any limiting factors? Is there a time limitation, or is there a point at which so many people will be doing it that the margins for success begin to dissipate?
It's a great question. I'm a social historian, and I'm a person
I have so many questions.
Yeah, I'm a person, you know, who survived entities like the Vietnam era. I think that humans have always survived in very bleak and complex situations. And so I think innovation is always going to be necessary.
Uh-huh.
And I think that in a swift and severe world, it may be true that the severity hits earlier in life to people.
Uh-huh.
But the truth of the matter is there's going to always need for innovation in humanity.
Okay. Okay. So you're saying as long as we keep up with the trends and I guess read books like yours and get opportunities like this to speak with people like you whose business it is to keep up with these kinds of things, then we will always be able as small business owners to find a place for ourselves to be profitable and make a contribution.
I would say that 100%. You got to be adept and adaptive, but also have a long antenna to listen to the new trends.
Okay. So those of us who are frugal, who look for what our customers want and ask the right questions and use those answers to prepare for the future are the ones who are going to be a part of your surprising solution.
I'm with you. That's what
okay.
the book is about.
Excellent. Well, I strongly suggest to my listeners that this is a good and meaty book to get into. The holidays are coming. If you have some downtime, this is a really good one. It's broken up into several chapters, so you can choose, you know, the one or two that you think apply to you most. The Money Matters one is one of my favorites. Dr. Bruce Piasecki, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been great to have you.
I appreciate the time, Donna Maria, and I learn from people, so comment through the email or at Amazon.com. And I'll learn how to do it better next time.
Right, and tell us your email address one more time.
It's Bruce, like the name, B-R-U-C-E, at A, as in Apple, H Health, C as in Control, Group, AHCGroup.com.
Right, and that's the .com as well, AHCGroup.com. And check out the book on Amazon.com where you can leave comments about it. And visit AHCGroup.com to get some more information about the services that Bruce offers and some of the writings that he's, which may not be one of the companies that go to one of his workshops, but certainly a lot of his writing affects all of us as small business owners and also as consumers. Excited to have you here. I want you to join me next week, November 30th, when Steve Wilkinghoff will be here. He's the author of Found Money, and he's going to be sharing simple strategies for uncovering the hidden profit and cash flow in your business. I'll see you then. In the meantime, have a fantastic and safe and happy Thanksgiving. I will see you next week on November 30th. In the meantime, enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way.
You're listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com.